Welcome to this podcast. I'm Dr. Fiona Anderson, Trustee and Learning, Teaching and Continuing Professional Development Officer of the Design History Society. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Alice Twemlow, the guest judge for this year's Design Writing Prize. Dr. Alice Twemlow is a research professor at the Royal Academy of Art in The Hague. She's also professor in the Wim Kruel Chair in History, Theory and Sociology of Graphic Design and Visual Culture at the University of Amsterdam. Previously, she was head of the Master Department in Design, Curating and Writing at Design Academy Eindhoven. And before that, she was the chair of the MFA in Design Criticism and the MA in Design Research, Writing and Criticism at the School of Visual Arts in New York. She has an MA and a PhD in History of Design, and her book, Sifting the Trash, A History of Design Criticism, was published by MIT Press in 2017. So good morning, Alice, or good afternoon as it is in The Hague, where you are in your office over there. I'm really interested to hear your views on design writing and also to talk to you about this year's Design Writing Prize. Mm. Now, you have, you know, a wealth of experience in teaching in relation to writing. It'd be great if you could explain to us how you see the practice of writing linking with your teaching practice.
Well, thanks, Fiona. And thanks to the Design History Society for having this prize in the first place. I think it's fantastic, as you can imagine. And I'm just delighted to be able to have the opportunity to talk about writing in relation to design history, two of my very favourite things. So this is a real pleasure. So, yeah, how does my practice as a writer link to my practice as a teacher? And it's really good, actually, to have a question like that, to sort of take a chance to disentangle those practices, because very often, for me, they're all bound up in one another in interesting ways. For the purposes of this conversation, yeah, I would maybe think about my teaching of writing in sort of different groups of people that I work with. It's all related. It's all about opening windows, I feel. You know, just whether it's students in design and art or PhD candidates or the tutors and colleagues I work with, I want to show them that some preconceptions people may have had about writing, academic writing, what it's supposed to be, doesn't necessarily have to be the case. I like to show possibilities and to find people's strengths, whatever they may be. And I think this is the thing about writing, is that very often it's felt that somehow, and I'm speaking now in the context of perhaps a design and art school and academy, writing is seen as a worry, as a problem, something that someone else is going to teach somewhere else. You know, either it's assumed the students learnt it somewhere along the way, or that someone else is taking care of it. It really does get treated like that sometimes. So I like to take it head on and deconstruct it bit by bit, really, and to build it back up again for students so they feel really comfortable. The other thing about writing is that sometimes people have learnt it somewhere else, and then they have, you know, sometimes it has to be about kind of unlearning some aspects of that, dissolving some preconceptions about what is academic writing. Because very often those preconceptions end up tripping people up because they want to shove in lots of jargon and make it somehow obscure, as if that is what academic writing is. So it's two things. I think in some cases I'm building up using building blocks, and in other cases we're deconstructing and then rebuilding. I'd love to just, if I could, mention a few of the ways that I do teaching writing, because maybe that's of interest. And again, I'm speaking across different groups, whether that's design and art students, PhD candidates in artistic research, or tutors, or even the students I worked with in New York in that course you mentioned in the introduction, Decrit, which was a program solely devoted to writing about design. So just to mention a few of the things I like to do, I really like to create constraints, and those could be, for example, time, you know, using timed writing. People really respond to that. They love it, that you can just release it. So many of the stresses, I think, you know, you have to produce something in this time, and whatever we've got, we'll work with it. And sometimes that's very helpful. So I like using the constraints and affordances of genre, mode, or format. So by that, I mean, what is the motivation of the writing? What is the mixing genres, things like that, or using a particular genre for one thing? Or a format could be whether it's a letter or whether it's a press release or whether it's a film script. We can also use the constraints of different technologies, like are we going to try and write a novel on WhatsApp? It's possible, but not recommended. Word counts or perspectives. So those are some of the things I like to work with. I often work with fiction, and just as an example, we did a class a while back where we were looking at how do you communicate a nuclear waste deposit or repository to people 10,000 years in the future? And we ended up writing myths, you know, sort of coming back to this idea of mythology and how that might be a good way to sort of instill the warning through the generations. And the students loved it. And we wrote apology letters to the future to accompany these myths. And in another class, when we did beach cleanups and we used the findings from those beach cleanups to create stories, and then we wrote reports from archaeologists in the year 2320 who were trying to make sense of the things they found in the ground, things like plastic coffee cup lids, and how would they maybe be sedimented into the earth and the flooding we imagine that would happen by then at that point, and then how would an archaeologist try and read back and understand us? So lots of speculative, fictional kind of techniques I find to be very part of that opening of windows I talked about with in terms of writing. And then just last thing to mention on this point would be, it's again liberating, you know, say you've got the kind of student who is like is having some issues with writing, problems, you know, like finds it difficult. I think there's so much you can do, which to open it up. Some of them find they like to use, you know, maybe use notes function on their phone. In fact, they find that very liberating. And then we just piece together the fragments. You can build an essay using images and then write captions. And then the captions get longer and longer. And sometimes then they become the whole piece, which is a sort of stealth approach, I must admit. And then I love visual essays. I love collage writing. But the last thing I wanted to mention here is that I think, and I just heard this podcast yesterday, so that's why it's in my mind, the Zimbabwean author, Noviolette Bulawayo, says, or she just mentioned in passing, that writing is a form of speaking. And I really, really love that idea and how it reminds us that writing is about your voice and it's about accessing your voice. And in her case, she's speaking on behalf of people, and that has a kind of accountability built in. But even if you're just speaking on behalf of yourself, the fact that it is something spoken, I think, makes it much more authentic and is a good place to kind of start. So anyway, that was a long answer. I'm sorry, but I have so much to say about this that I just wanted to get that all out there. But yeah.
No, thank you for sharing. These are really inspiring examples of how creative writing can be, whether it's connected to either teaching or the actual writing itself. And that links so strongly with the Design Writing Prize and the reason why the Society's running it. Just looking a bit more depth, more specifically in relation to writing and design history, how do you see the relationship between writing and design history?
I find it fascinating. And I think, you know, I think that's sort of what I wrote my whole PhD and then my book on was kind of that, which was, it's called Sifting the Trash, A History of Design Criticism. I guess it sort of started with a bit of a hunch or something that felt a bit off to me about the way we deal with writing in design history. So certainly, I mean, this is going to age me, but we used to have, when we were looking at articles or essays, we were given them as photocopies or in readers or disembodied is how I felt they were. So I really do feel that writing articles and pieces of writing are just as much a designed entity as anything else, you know, and they really think of all the ways we learn to study a designed object. We put it back into context. We re-establish the links, the network, the actors and the agents that sort of give it its reality in that particular historical moment. And so I wanted to do the same thing with writing, not just to sort of do some kind of historical reenactment, but rather just to go back and understand that writing gains, and here I'm kind of thinking, I'm imagining in my mind an article let's say by someone like Rainer Banham, that very often gets anthologized and, like I said, sort of disembodied. But if you put it, reinsert it back into the magazine amongst all the other articles in that particular configuration of art direction, next to that particular advertisement, with that particular letter from the reader, it creates the atmosphere and energy in which it was written. And they very often were written with a great energy. For a very, you know, Banham, for example, was writing, you know, weekly columns. So there's a kind of drive and energy contained in that that we lose a bit of when it becomes this sort of slightly timeless, anthologized butterfly specimen, if you know what I mean. So I guess that was a sort of impetus to kind of look at how design criticism has behaved historically or you know, been constituted historically. So I don't want to go into the whole book, it's its own thing, but two themes emerged from looking at all of that. One was this idea of kind of sickness of society in relation to design, and the other was this idea of waste and trash, and the idea of maybe a critic as a kind of almost like a gatekeeper to the landfill. And those were the themes I explored in that book. But I also wonder if maybe it was good to mention here how I see it now, because I still think there's some stuff to work through. And I'm thinking here about design history's relationship to academic publishing. I don't want to make blanket statements because, of course, some academic publishing is really trying to be as innovative as possible and moving on. But there's still, I feel, something odd that happens where it is perceived that to get your article blind peer reviewed is superior to having it edited in a regular magazine, right? And I'm speaking from painful experience here, because when I presented my CV to Dutch academics, they pointed out for me that half of it was in fact utterly invisible to them, completely worthless and useless, because it wasn't blind peer reviewed. It had been published in, well, you know, God forbid, mass read, you know, mass market publication that people actually read, you know. And I really respect academia, so I'm not going to cause a fuss. I'm always just a little bit surprised, because there's so much I think you can learn from an incredible magic that can happen between a writer and an editor, a really good editor, in transforming an article and in enhancing the argument and the message, that I don't find always happens in this blind peer review process, where those individuals who are being asked for their expertise don't have the accountability of that publication all the time to make it the best piece of writing it possibly can be. And I think sometimes writing in the context of design history suffers because of that.
Well, I think that's these are important points, and I think they really connect really strongly with why the Design History Society runs the Design Writing Prize, that we are really interested in promoting and celebrating other types of writing beyond academic writing and looking at a whole sphere, design writing as a whole sphere rather than just purely at academic writing. We are really interested in extending and encouraging writing that goes beyond that very limited field. So moving on from that, I mean, you've really put forward very strongly the importance of critical writing in design. What do you think are the most important critical issues in contemporary design writing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose you just have to sort of pause a minute and think, well, it's a writing, whether it's about design or not. So it's sort of what are the most important issues. And then for me, that is climate crisis and advocating for climate justice specifically. And so that's something I will always prioritize. And I suppose it creates its own filter in a way for me when I'm looking around at my designed environment and trying to figure out what it is I'll be writing about. But I think everyone has their own, you know, issue they want to deal with. And I think it's just important to be reporting from its front lines to the extent that you can, and using design as a lens for examining those issues in a way that maybe a regular news reporter is not doing. It gives a different perspective. So I think it's super important and essential. I'm just trying to think of an example. Well, okay, so this morning I heard on the news that you've got these women, well, young girls in Afghanistan all showing up for school this morning, expecting to be readmitted to school. And at the very last minute, the Taliban decided no. And it said that the reason was they had a sudden concern about school uniforms. So I'm just imagining if I was about to write about this, you know, I would start with a school uniform. And that would be my lens for trying to understand the implications of what so-called design decisions had been made in that particular instance that had led to such a terrible situation. You know, I think it's just a matter of kind of where you position yourself. But the other thing I wanted to probably should say about this, and this is something maybe comes back a bit, sounding a bit kind of teacherish or something, but I do think what we really need to do, like a really important issue, like as writers, is to kind of really claim the first person and the first person plural and to situate it. So be really responsible about that. And by that, I mean, you know, when you sometimes see a student essay or in any essay, it says, in our use of mobile phones or, you know, use as the first person plural in this kind of very general globalizing sense without being attentive to the specifics of privilege and whatever kind of privilege or geographical perspective. So I do think it behooves us to be even more attentive to that. And where we get out of our range, turn things over, allow other voices. And here I'm thinking of the massive influx of migrant populations we're about to be collaborating with, basically, in our combined history writing as a result of, well, conflict and climate crisis, and how to sort of create a space that is one authentic to one's own voice, conveys one's beliefs, but also admits when you reach the edge or the threshold of one's kind of experience and authority, and how to allow those other voices to come in. Sorry, that sounds a bit vague and abstract, but it's just something I'm thinking about as an urgency right now in terms of writing, and that maybe the kind of formats that we work with, like this kind of essay or article, sometimes feel too closed in. And you mentioned all these other alternative forms that the Design History Society Writing Prize is open to. And I'm really looking at that with an attentive eye, because I think it's almost like a political need right now to have a form of writing that is inviting and generous enough to include others. Do you know what I mean by that?
I do know what you mean, and I think what you're saying is very important. But I mean, it does relate to allowing other voices in, for acknowledging the other voices are there, and also about the immediacy, the greater immediacy you can get if you move beyond the academic peer review format and into other forms of writing. And I think that's something for the Design Writing Prize we're really aiming to encourage, is to encourage other formats. I mean, just to include some of the formats so listeners are aware of the variety of forms that we will accept, as well as essays, it can be interviews, reviews, or editorial commentary. I mean, just to give, with all your wonderful experience of writing and teaching writing and taking interviews an example, could you explain how you would say an interview can move beyond being just a transcript into being a great piece of writing?
Yeah, again, I want to underline how excited I am by this and that this sort of breadth of formats that you are encouraging. And I even hope people submit things that don't even fit those categories, you know, and that keep challenging us to expand them. But first of all, I would say, well, actually, a transcript could be a great piece of writing, so I wouldn't rule that out. But I'm glad that you put the attention on the interview, because it is a massively important mode of research, of course, that we all know in design history. But then at the School of Visual Arts, where I ran the design writing masters, for example, we had a whole semester class called Art of the Interview devoted to this, because we valued it so much. So we basically looked at, it was a teacher called Adam Harrison Levi, who had a lot of experience working in BBC documentaries. So, and I believe he trained at the V&A RCA Design History Programme as well. You see, so it all comes back there. So we broke down the interview into sort of constituent parts and the different varieties. And, you know, you've got your Q&A, which is the kind of one where, in a way, both your questions are still included, but you're really prioritising the voice of the interviewee. And it's a little bit of a form of flattery sometimes that goes on there. You basically, I think the answer to it is about editing. An interview still, even though it might seem like this linear thing, is actually what you want to do is to create a narrative arc. And a very skilled interviewer will do that through their questions, and therefore their transcript doesn't need that much editing, which is why I said actually a transcript can be a beautiful piece of writing. However, most of us mere mortals have to do a lot of mechanical work afterwards where we're moving things around and reorganizing. And as long as that's stated that that has been done, then that's okay. But then there are all these other types of interview where you're using the interview quotes in a more as material that you weave into your piece, whether that's a profile or an essay. And then it's sort of a cherry picking exercise. And again, you know, you're thinking of a narrative arc and you're shaping that material and you wield it to your purpose. So basically, I think it all comes down to whittling and editing with interview transcripts.
Okay, thank you. So building on that and looking a bit more broadly, which might make this a tougher question, what are the characteristics that you'd be looking for in the submissions to the Design Writing Prize? What makes a really excellent piece of design writing?
In terms of the design part, I'm very, very open to a very broad definition of design. So I'm really up for anything. I've yet to be surprised or shocked, I guess is a better way. You know, as long as you make a case for it. So I think that can be there, you know, that it can be that as a reader, we would learn something. We would really learn something, not only about design as a practice and a process and a set of values, but, you know, as what constitutes design. So that should be there. But in terms of good writing, I suppose there's all kinds of things, and I'll list out some things I value, but I don't want to put people off, because it's not that you should put all of these in one piece, otherwise it's going to be like a firework explosion. But you know, but some of the things I suppose I respond to, I think most of us do, you know, is some things we mentioned a bit earlier when I was saying that thing about writing being a form of speaking, and I'm really looking for voice. I'm looking for an authentic voice. Something that speaks from a lived experience and with a clarity, or a clarity, not that it has to be just boring and straightforward. I don't mean that clarity, but just not letting stuff get in the way of expressing a lived experience and a perspective. I think another aspect I really love and respond to is when you get a sense that the writer cares, that the writer didn't go with a cliche, didn't settle for the first word choice that came into the mind, but really thought about what was the right word, the right phrase to describe that texture or that smell or, you know, that experience of being with design. And that really shows and comes through that you feel like you're in the hands of a thoughtful, generous, careful writer when they're doing that well. That also comes through to things like careful citation, the generosity, you know, of proper referencing and footnoting, and how that can really enhance a reader's experience, again, knowing that there's a kind of careful lens being applied to this. I love specifics. I love the kind of the residue of someone's visit to the archive. I love primary sources. I want to know that someone was doing reporting, that someone was out there, whether that's being on a site, being close to their subject, or whether that's a building or an urban situation, or whether that's material they found in a historical archive or whatever. I love the specificity of particulars. And that's something I'm always kind of attentive to. This is going to sound really difficult. However, I also like it to be theoretically supported. But it only in a way that makes sense, you know. And I think this is the trickiest thing, perhaps, for writing, myself included, is to get that sort of balance where you can wield theory as a way of deepening your ideas and to sort of, yeah, give it a richer kind of complexion what you're writing, but without, again, getting in the way or obscuring or feeling like, oh, here comes the theory paragraph, you know? So I'll be looking for theory that's used in a kind of a supportive and exploratory kind of way. And then it can be truly wonderful. So those are some of the things. I probably have missed out all kinds of stuff. But those are the ones that come to my mind as being some characteristics I would look for. You know, and I suppose the last thing to mention would be just, obviously, there has to be a kind of sense of urgency and a relevance and the why we care aspect. But I think most people are already doing that today. I don't think we have to remind them so much. It's part of our atmosphere and culture right now. I suppose the last one would be the define your own terms thing. I really always look for this. Like, I want to know what this writer thinks of and how they have come to an understanding of a particular term, like, I don't know, entanglement or whatever. I'm sorry, that's rather overused, but you know what I mean? Like a term, I love it to be defined by the author for their purposes. And I think that gives it a sort of a crackle of excitement that more than if it was just something taken from somebody else. Yeah, so is that enough of kind of...
It's a really rich and inspiring evocation of what we're hoping to be reading in a few weeks' time when the submissions come in for the prize. And I'm sure there are lots of wonderful writing out there that we hope it all comes in so we can... we'll be showing it to you so you can judge it for us.
Yeah, I'm so excited to read it, Fiona. Yeah, but there's one last thing, if I'm allowed to. Can I mention
a
personal plea? So you don't have to do this, but, you know, because of my interest in, we haven't really talked about this yet, but my personal interest in climate issues is that I'm really interested in what happens to design after its period of usefulness is over. So we might call this post-use, design and disposal, the decay or not decay of design. But anyway, because if you think about the way the paradigms around design history have evolved, you know, we started off very much kind of production focused to kind of lay the groundwork. And then the time I came of age as a design historian was we were learning from material culture studies and we were very much into consumption. And then actually a colleague of mine, Grace Lees Maffei, introduced another term, mediation, which was another way of looking at design and how it circulates. I want to make a case for that other part. Yeah, this kind of design and disposal, the waste aspect of design that I suppose is part of all of three of those and should be part of all of those existing paradigms. But I'm really curious if any of those show up in the submissions of new ways to kind of forge the methods, the theoretical support, the language, and the sensitivity to writing about that particular aspect of design. I think that will be very, very interesting. And maybe it just needs a little bit of a boost to get going. That's why I'm mentioning it.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, I think we'd be delighted to receive writing that addresses those themes, but we're also looking very broadly as well, and really we're leaving things completely open in terms of kind of topics or themes or theoretical issues that people might want to look at, because that hopefully will bring in the greatest breadth of new ideas and writing, which is what we're looking for. So is there anything else you would like to add to close our discussion today, Alice?
No, I don't think so. I think that was probably it, you know, just to mention that's something. Yeah, and I didn't really want to say it like, you know, that's what should be entered to this competition. It's just more generally, like in terms of writing, I think there is that to me is a space that can grow and that needs attention. And there's also, because it's just such exciting work going on around it, you know, in things like garbology and discard studies and media archaeology and geobiology. And I think that design history can be enriched by exploring it. So that's what I meant there. But no, I'm just super excited, totally honoured to be in this position, glorious, luxurious position of reading your fantastic submissions. And I just want to assure you that I'm going to give it the time it deserves. And I'll be sitting in my apartment in Amsterdam, probably quite nearby to the Amstel River. And I shall set myself down comfortably with a big pot of coffee, and I will be just willing to be surprised and delighted. So there you go.
Fantastic. And thank you very much, Alice, for your very inspiring contribution today. It's been really great talking to you. So I'm now going to close our conversation by giving listeners some more information about the Design Writing Prize. We encourage design writers from around the world to submit entries. And if you're writing in a language that is not English, we welcome submissions that have been translated into English. I'd also like to remind listeners that the deadline for entries is the 28th of April 2022 by 1600 Greenwich Mean Time. And all of the information about the prize, including how to prepare and submit an entry, is on the Design History Society website at www.designhistorysociety.org. So once again, it's been really fantastic talking to you, Alice. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure, and we really look forward to reading this year's entries. Thank you.
Thank you.